Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 14th of April, these are our main stories. A major operation is underway in Yemen to swap hundreds of prisoners. Could this be a step towards lasting peace after 8 years of war? Police in Kenya are trying to track down and save members of a cult whose fellow believers have been found starving themselves to death. Russian oil exports hit a 3-year high despite Western sanctions over the invasion of Ukraine. Also in this podcast, a warning that what you paint on your fingernails could affect your long-term health.
I started breaking out in rashes, not just around my nails and cuticles, but my entire body. It wasn't just itchy, it was physically painful.
Let's start with a look at what's going on in Yemen. The UN says it's home to one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The people of Yemen are 8 years into a war by proxy that's being carried out between Iranian-backed Houthi rebels and Saudi Arabian-backed forces. It's pushed millions there to the brink of famine. David Gressley is the United Nations resident and humanitarian coordinator in Yemen. He describes the situation inside the country.
Well, the situation is still very grim on the ground. I mean, after 8 years of war, we have 21 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. That's two-thirds of the country. We continue to work very much on food security, nutrition, water delivery, support to hospitals. So many hospitals are now not functional. Landmines are littered all across the front lines, former front lines, that produce casualties almost two or three times a week, in fact.
Last month, though, there was a breakthrough when the powers who've been fueling the war inside Yemen, Iran and Saudi Arabia restored diplomatic ties. Today, Yemen moved another step closer to peace, beginning with an exchange of almost 900 prisoners between the warring sides. That's a major operation facilitated by the International Committee of the Red Cross. A UN-brokered deal has been in the works for months, and it's part of the diplomatic effort to end the conflict for good. A patchy truce has been in place since last year, and talks have been going on between the Saudis and the Houthi rebel movement to broker a more permanent peace. The Saudi delegation left Yemen today without a final deal, though more talks are on the horizon. So what impact might today's prisoner swap have on the conflict? That's a question I asked our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
A lasting truce, a sustained peace, is still a long way away, but it is closer than it has ever been in what is now nearly a decade-long conflict. What is happening today with the prisoner releases, a very emotional moment for so many Yemenis, but it is also a confidence-building step, a step that signals that there is possibility of some movement. Taking out one of the main engines driving this conflict, which is the animosity between the two regional heavyweights, Saudi Arabia, which backs what's called the internationally recognized government based in southern Yemen, and the Iranians who back the Houthis, who are in control of the north, who took power in a coup in 2014, is a very, very important factor which will help move this forward. But the hostilities and animosities between the Yemeni players is even more intense than it was when the Saudis first went in 2015.
Lise, you've been covering this war for quite some time. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the human cost of this war. Can you take us through how damaging it's been and what a truce would mean?
Oh, the human cost is unbelievable. unbearable to see when you go to all parts of Yemen and see the children with limbs that are stick thin, when you see families being pushed time and again by the war, families living on the edge, when you see whole communities mired in this, both the grinding poverty and that despair of never knowing when this war will end, you hold on, you hold fast to any sign that this war, this humanitarian crisis, will have a chance of being resolved. There is no humanitarian solution to this humanitarian crisis, which is one of the deepest in around the world. It will take a political solution. And even now, I should mention that even the steps taken so far, if they do move ahead, they will open the ports, they will open the airport, they will make it easier to get access to the people, to the millions, two-thirds of the population who need handouts just to survive.
You mentioned the political solution that's needed. We're seeing some small steps towards that today with this prisoner swap that's starting. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, I mean, in any conflict, the exchange of prisoners is one of the most searing moments. Thousands of Yemenis on all sides of this conflict have seen their loved ones languishing in prison. The fact that nearly 900 are being released today is going to be such a boost to people, but they do need peace.
Lise Doucette. Well, police in Kenya are searching for members of the Good News International Church after several people were found seriously ill in a forest in the coastal region of Kilifi. They'd apparently been told to starve themselves so they could get to heaven more quickly. Our correspondent in Nairobi, Ferdinand Ormondi, told us more about this gruesome story.
Police released what was a really disturbing statement. They said that they received intelligence report from somebody who went and claimed that there was somebody who was starving people from where he came, and were promising them that if they died, they would see Jesus Christ. And he also alleged that there could be several other people who have died and who are buried in mass graves in some forest not far from there. So police say they responded. That was yesterday, and today they did respond. And it's a very vast area because it is rural Kenya, and they say they drove over long distances trying to rescue these people who they had heard about, and they managed to get about 15. However, according to the senior police officer there, while they're trying to get them all and, you know, give them medical attention, 4 did not survive. 11 are hospitalized, 3 of them in critical condition.
And there are reports of a mass grave?
Yeah, so there is a suspicion that some others could have died before and could be buried. And the ones who have been identified as sick, I can see they're from different parts of the country and not necessarily the residents of that area. So it does appear that people could have traveled far and wide to go there. However, police are saying that they have been unable to go to the forest, first of all, because there is a lot of hostility from the residents there. And so it means that they have had to retreat, first of all, to, you know, plan how they would try and go in there and investigate these allegations to find out if they really are true that people died and got buried.
And Ferdinand, just tell us more a little bit about the pastor who's been linked to this church. What more do you know about him?
So it turns out that this is not the first time that he's been involved in cases that have led to deaths. He's somebody who was, arraigned in court recently in connection with the deaths of 2 children whose parents had joined the church. However, he was released on bail, which was set at less than $100. And that case was still being investigated. So now this has turned up again. There were claims that after he was charged, he had quit his preaching. But now on the evidence here right now, it clearly still have followers who are following what are clearly fatal teachings.
Ferdinand Ormondi. Oil exports from Russia reached their highest level in almost 3 years last month, despite the impact of sanctions. That's according to the International Energy Agency. But despite the increase, Russia's oil revenues remained significantly lower than last year. To explain that paradox, here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Since the European Union, the United States and other regions imposed bans or severe restrictions on imports of Russian oil, Moscow has been forced to seek new buyers. The flow of Russian crude and refined products to India and China in particular has increased sharply. But a price cap on Russian shipments engineered by the EU and the G7, along with a fall in global oil prices, have taken their toll on revenues. The IEA says oil exports from Russia rose by more than 500,000 barrels last month, but its revenues were 43% lower than in the same period a year ago.
Theo Leggett. Now to Beijing. A marching band playing a slightly shaky version of the Brazilian national anthem as President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was being welcomed by his counterpart Xi Jinping during his state visit to China. Since taking office in January, Lula has made it clear he wants to put Brazil back on the international stage after years of isolation under his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. Our reporter, João da Silva, is following the visit from Singapore. I asked him what both sides were hoping to get from this meeting.
For Lula, there's two sides to this visit. I think part of it is he wants to put Brazil back on the international stage. You know, under his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, he pursued a more isolationist foreign policy. He cultivated some friendships with the United States and also with Israel and also with some more populist leaders in Hungary and so on. But he neglected the multilateralism that is the tradition, at least of the previous Brazilian leaders, Dilma Rousseff. So Lula, now that he's returned to power, he wants to put Brazil back on the world stage. The other side of this for President Lula is, of course, trade and investment. The Brazilian government said in the lead up to this meeting today that they are expecting to sign some 20 bilateral agreements with China. Lula, again, he ran on a platform for fighting poverty back home and for boosting Brazil's stagnant economy. And he knows he cannot achieve those things without the support of Brazil's largest trading partner, which is, of course, China. So there is that expectation.
What about Xi Jinping? What does he want?
Xi Jinping right now is facing huge tensions with China's own largest trading partner, which is the United States. So Xi Jinping really wants to secure and retain and even increase the access that Chinese companies have right now to alternative markets. And of course, Brazil is an obvious choice here because Brazil is the biggest economy in Latin America. So it is very important for China to maintain its access to that market. And I'm very sure that the Chinese government was very pleased with Lula yesterday visiting the innovation center of Huawei in Shanghai. It is a very iconic visit, if you think about it. That specific tech company is at the center of U.S.-China tensions. The U.S. says that it poses a national security risk. And still, Lula went there and made that visit very, very public, very visible. It really signals that Brazil is taking a pragmatic approach. And of course, China is happy to see this. It means that it will retain its access to the very big Brazilian market.
João da Silva. There's a growing consciousness that the beauty products we use on our bodies, on our hair and skin, can have profound effects on our overall health. But nail polish? Most people would assume that's applied to such a small portion of our bodies, our nails, that it shouldn't really matter what those tiny bottles of nail polish contain. Well, think again. Doctors are now warning that very cheap gel nail polishes bought online are so toxic to some people that they cause life-changing allergic reactions. Our reporter, Nikki Cardwell, has been telling me more.
We're talking about an allergy, and this allergy starts in the same way that typically lots of dermatological problems will do. Anyone with eczema will know what they're looking for, starting with a rash. It could be small localised blisters. With this, a lot of the time it will start around the fingers. The nail can start lifting off, and in some cases people lose their nails entirely. But it's not just around the hands, the area where you think it would. It can emerge other places in the body. Anywhere that you touch with your fingers, i.e. those nails, it can occur there. You do see it also in the face. You can have breathing problems. I spoke to a lady in Newfoundland in Canada named Steph Hunt. young woman bought a cheap kit online, and within days she started to have very serious problems.
I started breaking out in rashes, not just around my nails and cuticles, but my entire body. It wasn't just itchy, it was physically painful. I started trying to do my nails on my own during COVID, and there was that whole kind of DIY phase for everyone of, you know, I can't go to my nail salon, I can't go to my hair salon, so I'm going to have to do this myself, not realizing there's all these risks involved.
So Steph talks about the dangers involved in using these cheap online kits, but it's not just limited to getting a few rashes that go away. There are some long-term effects, right?
Yes, and this is the crux of the problem. A lot of people that will have these allergies will treat them themselves at home. It'll go away. They think it's over. Only the extreme cases are going to the dermatologist, and this is where the problem arises. They are saying that anyone, no matter how bad or how minor this reaction will be, are stuck with it for life. Now, the problem is caused by a chemical known as acrylates, and there are lots of different types. They are used to strengthen products. It's acrylic. It's anything that it makes things solid and tough. They're used in bone cements. They're used in medical glues. They're used in lots of different ways, and usually the levels are very low. But once your body has been sensitized to them, in something like gel polishes, it means you are sensitized to them in every form. This can have implications in dentistry. All white fillings use acrylates to bond them to your body. I spoke to a professor of dentistry at the University of Amsterdam, Dr. Albert Feltzer. He says that it can have lifelong implications.
When you become allergic for acrylic, then you can't have any more any dental filling. No crowns, they're most times cemented with acrylic cement. You can't have a full denture because it's also in the same acrylic. You can't have an implant in your skull for your head. You can't have cemented hip or knee prosthesis implants. So this is a big problem, and it differs from all the others that it has so much implications for the rest of your life.
So, Nikki, what's the solution to all of this? I doubt we're going to convince many people to stop using nail polish. So what do we need to do?
We live in a global world. E-commerce is huge. People are always going to buy things online. But understand that when you buy them, there is a risk that goes with it. These are just some gel polishes that will cause this. Not all of them will. Look at the manufacturing standards of the countries they come from. Check the ingredients lists and look at the percentages. Make sure you know what you're buying.
Nikki Cardwell. Coming up, what's it like to be a modern cavewoman? We'll hear from an elite athlete in Spain who spent 500 days 70 metres deep in the earth.
I've been silent for a year and a half, not talking to anyone but myself.
We'll be back right after this.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
It's a cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus Group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2 from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Croatia's government has approved a significant increase in penalties for using Nazi-era slogans and symbols. The change follows a long campaign by the country's Jewish and Serbian minorities. Here's Guy Deloni.
Anyone who shouts "For the homeland ready" will now face a fine of €4,000. That's more than 20 times the previous maximum penalty. It was the salute of the Nazi-allied Ustasha movement, which governed the puppet independent state of Croatia during the Second World War. But it remains depressingly popular in modern times, particularly at football matches. Croatia's minority groups have accused the government of not taking the issue seriously. The Ustasha murdered hundreds of thousands of Serbs, Jews, Roma and political dissidents during their time in power.
Guy Deloni. Now we can bring you more developments on an extraordinary story you heard in our previous podcast, the dramatic arrest of a young, low-ranking member of the U.S. National Guard at his home in rural Massachusetts. Jack Teixeira will appear in court later today for leaking dozens of highly classified documents containing sensitive intelligence on a wide range of topics, including the war in Ukraine. So what do we know about him and why he might have leaked documents? Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Jack Teixeira is 21 years old and he's a member of the, or was a member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard. He joined the service apparently about 3.5 years ago. Separately, he oversaw a private channel on the video and chat app Discord called Thug Shaker Central, which is where the leaked documents first appeared. This group comprised about 24 people, mostly boys in their teens. And according to one member, they all bonded during the isolation of the COVID pandemic over a shared love of guns, God and military gear. Jack Teixeira was seen as the leader of this group, and apparently he started sharing these documents in a bid to educate fellow members of the group about world events, what was going on and so on. It's been reported that hundreds of pages of intelligence briefings were uploaded and shared in that chat group before some got posted outside of the group. But there's very little doubt, I think, that these documents were never meant to leave the very small corner of the internet that they originally inhabited. And Jack Teixeira's motive for sharing this classified information in the first place appears to have had more to do with gaining kudos within the group than it does with blowing the whistle on secret government activities.
David Willis in Washington. Well, staying with this story, Christian Treber is part of the visual investigations team from the New York Times, which first identified Jack Teixeira, thanks to the discovery of 27 new leaked documents.
These new documents that we got yesterday, there was like a granite countertop visible, and it stood out because it was different from the other photos. And we managed to talk to several people that, you know, were in that close community where the documents were initially leaked to see if there was anyone of interest with a username that may have more documents or could be the person that they were referring to as the OG, the original guy. One of them caught our attention. That was Jack, the person that we managed to identify. And basically using gaming profiles of him on Steam, which is very popular with gamers, we found connections to other social media, including close family members and photographs. So within 19 minutes, a photograph was found, and suddenly a colleague notes like, wait, that has a granite countertop and like white tiles. And then we were like, wait, what? So then we started matching the details and was like, wow, this matches. Once we found confirming information that he was an intelligence wing officer, you know, of the National Guard in Massachusetts here in the US, we were quickly to identify where he lived, you know, and where his family lives. And then we're like, should we just go there, you know? So actually, my colleagues, they were actually stationed outside the house. So we were right there when the raid happened. And if you imagine, that's within a couple of hours of finding the granite table, basically. It was a crazy day and night.
Christian Treber from the New York Times. Now, something that's happening here in Britain. Driverless cars on our roads. Already available in the US and Canada, Ford has launched the first hands-free car system here, called Blue Cruise, in one model of car. The technology's been approved by the Department of Transport for use on motorways, and it'll need a monthly subscription. Drivers will be able to take their hands off the wheel and their feet off pedals, but must still keep their eyes on the road. The managing director of Ford in Britain and Ireland, Lisa Brankin, told us how it works.
It's a hands-free driver assistance technology, and it's the first system of its kind to launch in Great Britain. So basically what you do when you get into the vehicle, you set the distance you want to travel from the car in front and the speed you want to travel. And then when the system feels it's safe and it's in a Blue Cruise zone, you can take your hands and your feet off the pedals and the car will manage your distance and a safe distance from the car around you. Will send you in the lane and will keep you at the speed that you want to travel at. So if you take your eyes off the road, there's a camera inside the vehicle that monitors your attention on the road. And if you don't pay attention, the car will prompt you to put your hands back onto the steering wheel. Very, very steadily and the system will keep prompting you, but at some point, if you don't respond, the car will really steadily slow down, so that it'll assume that potentially you're asleep or you're not able to take control, and the car will slow down to a stop. This technology is not autonomous driving, so the car isn't in control. Effectively, the driver's in control, which is why you need to pay attention. So we say your hands off the wheel, but your eyes on the road. So you've still got to have your eyes on the road and pay attention to what's going on.
Lisa Branken. South African architect Soumaya Valley is the woman behind the world's first ever Islamic Arts Biennale in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It aims to be the most significant showcase of contemporary and historic works of Islamic art from across the globe. In 2020, Soumaya became the youngest ever architect to be chosen to design the annual pavilion outside the Serpentine Gallery in London. My colleague, Anita Rani, has been talking to Soumaya and first asked her about her childhood.
I grew up in South Africa and I was born 5 or so days after Nelson Mandela was released from prison. So I really grew up at the fall of apartheid. I was 4 years old when South Africa became a democracy. I did grow up in a previously apartheid township called Lodium in South Africa. I'm very, very proud of my community and of my community upbringing as well. I grew up with a strong sense of what it means to live and be in a community. And it was a multi-religious community. Even though I grew up in and around Muslim rituals and Muslim life, many of our neighbors were Hindu and Christian, and we had a lot of solidarity as well. And I think also because everybody was so much against apartheid and so many people in our community were so active against it, we really found solidarity in each other.
So how did that upbringing inform the designs that you eventually went on to create as an architect?
My practice was founded by and through a love for Johannesburg. I really felt that there's so much that's interesting, there's so much that's rich, there's so much conceptual food in all of its diversity that's waiting to be translated into design and architectural form. But what I felt when I studied architecture and when I looked around at the profession was that all this exciting richness was not being translated into form. We really had a canon and a profession that was inherited from elsewhere. And we didn't have any architecture that was truly resonant with the phenomenon that we were seeing or the phenomena that we were seeing in the city around us. Architecture is so abstract. It sets up everything in our lives. And we really take it for granted because it's all around us. You know, it sets up all kinds of hierarchies. Also, as a South African, I think I understood that architecture affirms our place in the world. It tells us who we are and it affirms our sense of belonging.
So how did you go about establishing yourself? Because you have done so well, but establishing yourself in a typically male-dominated industry?
Well, I don't know. I think in the beginning I just went for it. I didn't think too much or think too hard. I knew that I had this desire to translate what I was interested in into design and architectural form. I didn't think much about it at the time. I think for a long time, my work and what I was doing was like speaking into a vacuum, especially because architecture and design is so abstract. But I think I just so much believed that there is so much to give and there is so much to learn from our cultures, from our traditions, and from who we are, that we absolutely have to take this opportunity on and translate it into form.
The architect Soumaya Valley. Finally, an elite athlete from Spain has today emerged from a cave where she's been living for 500 days, all in the name of science. Beatriz Flamini has been isolated from the outside world. She's missed events such as the invasion of Ukraine, the nail-biting outcome of the World Cup, and big news in Spain, the singer Shakira's divorce from her Spanish footballer partner. Harry Bly reports.
The moment Beatriz Flamini emerged from the cave, 70 metres underground, located just outside the city of Granada in southern Spain. She's seen wearing dark glasses, likely because it's the first time she's seen sunlight in more than 16 months. And she's met by a small group of reporters, deliberately small, so as not to overwhelm her.
I've been silent for a year and a half, not talking to anyone but myself. I lose my balance. That's why I'm being held. And if you allow me to take a shower, I haven't touched water for a year and a half.
She described the experience as excellent and unbeatable. While in the cave, Beatrice was closely monitored by scientists, keeping a close eye on her physical and mental well-being. This included a team of physical trainers, cave specialists called speleologists, and psychologists who were researching how social isolation underground would affect her circadian rhythms and sleep. It's said while in the cave, she experienced extremes of terror and euphoria, existential explorations, mood swings, hallucinations, and issues with memory and concentration. For 500 days, Beatrice had no direct human contact. Instead, she would drop off recordings made using a video camera as an exchange point in the cave system for researchers to collect and in turn drop off any supplies like food. In her downtime, she did exercises, painting, and she knitted woolly hats. Her support team provided 1,000 litres of water and 60 books for her to read. When she first descended in November 2021, Beatrice was 48. She celebrated 2 birthdays there alone since then. An experienced climber and mountaineer, she didn't just volunteer for this challenge, it was her idea. In 2010, 33 miners became trapped in the San Jose copper and gold mine in Chile. The 69 days spent there earned them a place in the Guinness Book of Records. While this challenge hasn't been confirmed by Guinness yet, it's almost certainly a world record in itself.
Harry Bly. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Celia Hatton. Until next time, goodbye.